This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. Look, studying for the Series 3 can easily turn into an absolute grind, right? But Cert Fuel has a full Series 3 course built to bypass that completely.
Yeah, it's a completely different approach.
Exactly. They've got adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It actually figures out where your blind spots are, you know, and helps you patch them up before test day. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend it. It's a game changer.
So jumping right in, there is this fascinating illusion when you first start looking at financial markets, like the charts, the flashing numbers, all the Greeks, it all looks incredibly precise.
No, absolutely. Like an engineering diagram or something.
Yeah, like an x-ray. You break your arm, the x-ray shows a jagged white line and it's a binary outcome, broken or not broken.
Right. Very black and white.
But the moment you step into the options market and specifically option spread strategies, that x-ray machine just shatters. We are no longer looking at binary outcomes.
Not even close.
We are navigating this wild landscape built entirely on shifting probabilities, decaying time frames, and like overlapping risk management matrices. I mean, it gets murky incredibly fast.
Diagnostic muddy waters is, it's a perfect way to describe it. And clearing up that specific murkiness is our primary mission today, diving deep into option spread strategies for the Series 3 exam.
Which is huge, right?
The stakes here are definitely not trivial. For anyone preparing for this test, part one, the market knowledge section, that makes up roughly 71% of the entire exam.
Man, that is a staggering chunk. 71%.
Yeah, it's massive.
That means this isn't material you can just stim while drinking your coffee, right? You absolutely can't rely on rote memorization to get you through a weighting like that.
Oh, definitely not. In fact, the test writers intentionally designed the exam to break people who just memorize flashcards.
Wait, really? They build it like a trap.
Exactly. Because think about it. If you learn a definition without understanding the underlying mechanics, a slightly rephrased question will completely derail you.
That makes sense.
So our goal today is to dissect the actual engine of these trades, the underlying architecture. Once you understand the engine block, you can solve literally any math problem or scenario they throw at you.
Even if the vocabulary looks totally unfamiliar at first glance.
Precisely.
All right, well, let's strip the engine down to the block then. The core architecture of everything we're covering today is the vertical spread.
Yes, the foundational building block.
And the sources tell us a vertical spread basically involves buying one option and selling another of the exact same type, right? On the exact same underlying futures contract with the exact same expiration date.
That's right. Everything matches.
The single solitary variable is just the strike price.
What's fascinating here is that when you peel away all the dense financial jargon, every single position we will analyze today is simply a bet on the gap between two strikes.
I love that. Just a bet on the gap.
That is the entire secret to this unit. You're just placing a mathematical bet on the distance between strike A and strike B and how that specific distance changes as the market fluctuates.
And as time bleeds away, right?
Exactly. Time is always a factor.
So to visualize this math without your eyes just completely glazing over, because I know how dry this can get,
yeah.
Let's think about the different types of traders executing these bets.
Good idea. Put a face to the math.
Right. So you have the guy at the casino who just loves the adrenaline spike. Let's call him Desperate Dave.
Desperate Dave. I like it.
Dave swings for the fences, right? He wants directional exposure, and he is perfectly willing to pay cash up front out of his own pocket for the dream of a massive payout.
High risk, high reward.
Exactly. He wants the market to make a huge move, and he pays a premium for a ticket to that show.
Contrasting with that adrenaline-fueled approach is more of an insurance company mentality.
Okay, who's our insurance company?
Let's think of a trader named Cautious Kathy. And Kathy categorically refuses to pay to play. She prefers being the house.
Smart lady.
Very. She collects cash up front from people like Dave, acting as the underwriter, and then she just waits out the clock.
So she just wants nothing to happen.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Her ideal scenario is zero drama, sideways movement, and letting time decay do all the heavy lifting so she can just pocket the premium she collected on day one.
Okay, so these two mentalities dictate everything about how options are spread. But before we even touch the mechanics of a bull call spread or whatever, we need the universal laws of physics that govern Dave and Kathy's trades.
The golden rules.
Right, the master keys. If you master these three overarching rules, you essentially have the master key to reverse engineer any exam question, no matter how convoluted the scenario seems.
And the foundation of that master key is rule one. the debit versus credit rule or the DNC rule.
The DNC. Got it.
Every single vertical spread you construct will either result in a net outflow of cash from your account, which is a debit, or a net inflow of cash to your account, a credit.
Okay, so think about Desperate Dave going out on a Friday night. He hits this exclusive club in the city and pays a massive cover charge just to get through the door.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
That cover charge is a debit. Money left his wallet before he even ordered a drink, right? To justify that upfront cost, he needs the party inside to be legendary.
He needs it to go wild.
Exactly. He needs the crowd to expand, the energy to get chaotic. He needs the whole experience to distend or widen. Debit, distend, widen.
That's a great mnemonic.
So if you pay a debit, you absolutely need the gap between those strike prices to widen.
The structural reality of paying a debit means you bought the more expensive option, right?
Right.
And you sold the cheaper one to offset the cost.
Right, so you're out of pocket.
Yes, you are net long the premium. For that premium to appreciate in your favor, the options must move deep into the money, which intrinsically forces the spread between their values to widen toward its maximum mathematical limit.
Makes total sense.
Now look at cautious Kathy. She skips the club entirely.
Typical Kathy.
Right. Instead, she takes a $200 deposit up front to watch her hyperactive golden retriever for the long weekend. She collects a credit.
And what does she want? She just wants that dog to sleep for 3 days straight.
She wants peace and quiet.
Yeah. She wants the weekend to close out peacefully. And she wants any potential chaos or property damage to narrow down to zero. Credit, close, narrow.
Perfectly said.
She took the cash up front, so her only goal is for the gap between those options to collapse so she can keep the money without doing any actual work.
Now listen to me closely here. This is a prime location for an exam trap. This is where the exam tries to get you.
Oh, flag this. Everyone listen up.
The test will present a very complex paragraph about a trader executing a credit spread on crude oil futures. And one of the multiple choice answers will casually state, the trader expects the spread to widen.
Sneaky.
Very. If you see the word credit and the word widen in the same logical framework, you cross it out immediately. Debits must widen toward the strike difference. Credits must narrow toward zero. End of story.
Okay, which brings us to rule two, the sanity check. This is the ultimate mathematical anchor.
My favorite rule.
So let me ask you, the listener, a direct question. Pause and think about this. If you're trading a spread where the two strike prices are 100 and 110, what is the absolute theoretical maximum that the gap between those two numbers can be?
Think about the raw math for a beat.
I'll give you a second. Okay, you got it. It's 10. 110 minus 100 is 10.
The strike difference is permanently fixed at 10.
It literally cannot be 11. It cannot be 12. The absolute bounds of reality for this trade are set at 10.
Right, because that gap is bounded by those two specific strikes at one single expiration date. A vertical spread structurally caps both the maximum profit and the maximum loss.
It's a closed system.
Exactly. You are trading within a closed system. So the formula that emerges from this closed system, the sanity check you was utilized on test day, is that maximum profit plus maximum loss will always equal the strike difference.
Oh, that is so clean. So if your strike difference is 10 and your calculations show a max loss of 4, your max profit just has to be 6.
4 plus 6 equals 10.
Because 4 plus 6 is 10. If you calculate a max profit of 5 and a max loss of 3, but your strikes are 10 points apart, well, you don't even need to reread the question.
You already know you messed up the math.
Yeah, you made a math error. 5 plus 3 is 8, not 10. The exam loves offering multiple choice options where the profit and loss figures just don't foot back to the strike difference.
It acts as an immediate filter for bad data. You can eliminate half the answers without doing a single complex calculation.
That is a massive time saver. Okay, rule three, the pairing.
Right. The market provides two distinct methods to express any directional opinion. If you analyze a chart and determine the market is fundamentally bullish, you can express that view through a debit spread using calls, or a credit spread using puts.
Two paths to the same destination.
Exactly. And if the macroeconomic data turns bearish, you can deploy a debit spread using puts or a credit spread using calls.
But wait, why build the system with two different ways to say the exact same thing? If I think gold is going up, why do I need a call option strategy, A&E a put option strategy?
It's all about accommodating different tolerances for risk and different assumptions about implied volatility.
Ah, Dave versus Kathy again.
Exactly. Do you want to pay capital up front for a larger potential payout, accepting that you lose your entire investment if the market chops sideways?
Like Dave.
Or do you want to collect a smaller cap premium up front, knowing you still profit even if the market does absolutely nothing, but exposing yourself to a larger relative loss if you are dead wrong.
Like Kathy.
Right. The market ecosystem requires both the Dave mentality and the Kathy mentality to function.
Okay, so Dave and Kathy are analyzing a live market. Let's apply these golden rules in a practical scenario. We'll look at the bullish plays. Both traders are staring at their terminal, reading the order flow, and they are utterly convinced this specific futures contract is going to rally hard. The market is going up.
Desperate Dave executes a call bull spread. This is his signature debit play. He buys the lower strike call and simultaneously sells the higher strike call.
Right, because we know the lower strike call is the expensive one. The right to buy gold at $2,000 is inherently more valuable than the right to buy it at $2,500.
Obviously.
So Dave is buying the expensive lower strike and selling the cheaper higher strike. He is paying a net debit. But here's my question. Why not just buy an outright call?
Good question.
If he is so convinced the market is rallying, why cap his gains by selling that higher strike at all?
Well, buying an outright naked call provides theoretically unlimited upside, sure, but the capital requirement is massive. Plus, time decay, theta is constantly eroding the position.
So he's fighting time.
Yes. Dave mitigates this by selling the higher strike call. The premium he collects from that sale directly finances the purchase of the expensive lower strike call.
Oh, wow. So it's basically a discount.
Exactly. He significantly reduces his out-of-pocket cost and lowers his break-even point. The trade-off, of course, is that the short call acts as a hard ceiling on his profits.
Okay, let's run the engine on the math. I want to see this. Dave is looking at the 100 and 110 strikes. He buys the 100 call, sells the 110 call. After netting the premiums, he pays a total debit of 4.
Okay, tracking.
So, listener, what is the absolute worst-case scenario for Dave? You paid 4 points out of pocket to get into this trade. Think about it.
The worst-case scenario is a complete market collapse.
Right.
Say the futures contract tanks to 80. At expiration, the right to buy at 100 is totally worthless because the market is trading way down at 80.
And the right to buy at 110 is obviously just as worthless.
Exactly. Both options expire completely out of the money. Dave loses his initial investment, so his maximum loss is strictly capped at the net debit paid, which is 4.
And we just pull out our sanity check formula to find the upside. The strike difference between 110 and 100 is 10. If the max loss is 4, the max profit just has to be 6.
But let's look at the actual mechanics of why that happens.
Walk me through it.
Assume the market explodes upward to 150. Dave exercises his right to buy at 100. He is securing the asset 50 points below market value. Huge win.
But wait, he sold the 110 call, right?
Yes. However, the trader he sold the 110 call to will now exercise their right. Dave is forced to turn around and sell that exact same asset to them at 110.
Huh.
He captured 10 points of gross profit from the market movement, the exact difference between the strikes.
But he paid 4 points to enter the trade.
Right. 10 minus 4 yields a net maximum profit of 6.
That is so cool. Call bull spread, debit paid, needs to widen, max loss is the debit. Max profit is the strike difference minus the debit. It's just a beautifully elegant, bounded system.
It really is.
Now let's pivot to cautious Kathy. She is looking at the exact same bullish chart, but Kathy refuses to pay a debit. She implements the put bull spread.
This is where we shift into credit logic. Kathy sells the higher strike put and buys the lower strike put.
Because the right to sell an asset at a high price is way more valuable than the right to sell it at a low price.
Therefore, the higher strike put commands a much larger premium. By selling the expensive 110 put and buying the cheaper 100 put, Kathy takes in a net credit of 4. Cash hits her account immediately.
Okay, we need to spotlight a massive exam trap here. The exam tries to get you, because the human brain loves shortcuts, right? Novice traders wire their brains to associate calls with bullish and puts with bearish.
Oh, it happens all the time.
So when the exam describes a strategy entirely composed of put options, the immediate instinct is to yell out puts, therefore bearish.
And yielding to that instinct will destroy your score.
Break it down for us.
We must analyze the action being taken, not just the instrument. Selling a put option means you are underwriting risk. You are taking on the contractual obligation to buy the underlying futures contract if the market price falls below your strike.
So if Kathy writes a 110 put, she's basically promising the market, if prices crash below 110, I will step in and buy at 110.
Right. And an underwriter only makes that promise if they are highly confident the market will not crash. Putting the higher put is an intensely bullish posture.
Got it. So Kathy gets paid that net credit of 4 to act as the underwriter. Now apply the dog sitting logic. Credit, close, narrow. If the market rockets up to 150, nobody is going to force Kathy to buy the asset at 110 when they could just sell it on the open market for 150. Both puts expire worthless. The spread between them narrows to absolute zero, and Kathy just walks away with the 4 points she collected on day one.
Her maximum profit is simply the net credit received.
Let's run the sanity check for her risk. Strike difference is 10. Max profit is 4. Her maximum loss must be 6.
The mechanics of this loss occur if the market plummets to 50, let's say. Kathy is contractually forced to buy the asset at 110 due to the short put. She's sitting on a massive unrealized loss.
Yikes.
But remember, she bought the 100 put as an insurance policy. She exercises that long put, forcing someone else to buy it from her at 100.
So she takes a 10-point loss on the turnaround?
Right. But she already has the 4 points of premium she collected at entry. 10 minus 4. Net loss. 6.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second and hold Dave and Kathy up against each other. They both had the exact same bullish market outlook. They both wanted the market to rise.
Same view, different vehicles.
Right. Dave used a debit to try and capture 6 points of profit while risking 4 points of capital. He needs the spread to widen. Kathy used a credit to capture 4 points of profit while risking 6 points of capital. She needs the spread to narrow.
The relationship is perfectly inverse. Dave's debit strategy accepts a smaller initial risk in exchange for a larger potential reward, but it requires a significant market movement to realize that reward.
He needs the adrenaline.
Right. And Kathy's credit strategy accepts a larger potential risk in exchange for a smaller reward, but she profits even if the market just stagnates. The options market is a beautifully balanced seesaw of risk and probability.
So Dave and Kathy have a great setup when the market is roaring. But what happens to these exact same mechanics when the floor falls out?
Things get interesting.
Let's leave the bustling, sunny floor of the stock exchange for a second. I want you to picture a damp, freezing cave. The temperature plummets. We are in a bear market now. Panic selling is everywhere. How do our traders flip their scripts?
Well, the environment completely changes, but their core personalities remain identical. Desperate Dave still wants to pay capital up front to chase a larger directional payout.
Typical Dave.
So he deploys the put bear spread.
Okay, the put bear spread is Dave's debit play for a crashing market. He buys the higher strike put and sells the lower strike put.
Correct.
And because he is buying the right to sell high, which is the expensive option, and selling the right to sell low to finance it, he pays a net debit.
It is the exact mirror image of his call bull spread. Paying for a naked, outright put is incredibly expensive in a crashing market because implied volatility usually spikes.
Everyone wants insurance when the house is on fire.
Exactly. By selling the lower put against it, he caps his downside protection but drastically reduces his entry cost. Let's say he pays a debit of 4. And because it is a debit, what does he need?
He needs the spread to distend, to widen. As the market crashes, the gap between the intrinsic value of those two puts widens toward the strike difference.
The math remains anchored. Strikes at 110 and 100. Debit paid is 4. If the market suddenly reverses and shoots to the moon, both puts expire worthless. Dave's max loss is the 4 points he paid.
Sanity check time.
Right. If the market crashes to 0, the spread widens to its maximum capacity of 10 points. He collects 10 minus the 4 he paid up front for a max profit of 6. The engine is identical. It's just pointed at the floor instead of the ceiling.
So what about cautious Kathy? Sitting in the same bear cave, she still wants to play the insurance company. She believes the market will stay down, but she wants to collect premium up front.
She executes the call bear spread.
Okay, call bear spread. She sells the lower strike call and buys the higher strike call.
Right. The right to buy an asset at a cheap price is incredibly valuable. Kathy writes that lower strike call, taking in a massive premium.
But selling naked calls in any market is borderline suicidal, right? Because the upside risk is technically infinite.
Exactly. So she buys the cheaper, higher strike call as a catastrophic insurance policy. Yeah. And let's say she nets a credit of 4.
Her thesis is simple. Collect premium and hope the market stays down. If prices stay below the lower strike, nobody exercises their right to buy, both calls expire worthless, the spread narrows to 0, and she keeps the credit.
This sets up another major exam trap.
Let's hear it.
If an exam answer says a call bear spread wants the spread to widen, what do?
You laugh. Yeah. Literally, you laugh because they applied debit logic to a credit spread.
Exactly. A call bear spread results in a net credit. Credits categorically never want the spread to widen. Credits require the spread to narrow. The moment you see Wyden linked to a credit position, the answer is mathematically false.
Let's consolidate this into a master matrix. This is the synthesis of the directional plays. Listen to this. Pay a debit, you want it to distend Wyden.
Yes.
Your maximum loss is hard capped at the debit you paid. Your maximum profit is the strike difference minus that debit. Take a credit. Your fundamental goal is for the spread to close narrow. Fix that in your brain. Your maximum profit is the credit you received. Your maximum loss is the strike difference minus that credit. In every single scenario, the vertical structure bounds the risk on both sides.
That matrix covers the entirety of directional trading. But, you know, up until this point, both Dave and Kathy were required to form an opinion on market direction.
They had to guess up or down.
They had to be definitively bullish or definitively bearish. But what happens if a trader analyzes the macroeconomic landscape and concludes they have absolutely no idea which way the market will break?
Very common scenario.
What if they want to remove directional risk entirely and simply monetize the inexorable passage of time?
Oh, this is where the strategy shifts from directional bets to temporal bets. We are moving into the realm of the time traveler, the calendar spread.
Yes.
To really internalize this, let's dump the bear cave. I want to visualize a completely bizarre manufacturing plant. Okay? Picture a melting ice cube factory.
I'm trying to visualize a factory entirely dedicated to melting ice.
Walk onto the factory floor with me. You see these long steel tables, and on every single table, there are two pieces of ice. One is a small standard ice cube that was pulled from the freezer an hour ago. It is melting aggressively. Water is pooling around it. The structural integrity is just vanishing by the second.
Okay, I see it.
Next to it on the table is a massive industrial block of ice, freshly pulled from a deep freeze. It is barely sweating. This factory floor is the physical manifestation of theta, the Greek metric for time decay.
That is a highly effective way to conceptualize an option calendar spread. With the vertical spreads we analyzed earlier, we utilized two different strike prices expiring on the exact same date.
Right.
A calendar spread flips that architecture 90 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
It is a horizontal time spread. We utilize the exact same strike price, but two different expiration dates.
Same strike, different time horizon. So how do we trade the ice cubes in this factory? The strategy is to sell the near-term option, the fast-melting ice cube. You collect premium for it. Simultaneously, you buy the longer-dated option, the slow-melting block of ice. Because the longer-dated option has significantly more time value embedded in its premium, it is always more expensive. Therefore, executing a calendar spread typically requires a net debit.
The engine powering this trade relies on the non-linear nature of time decay. Options do not lose their time value at a steady flat rate.
It's not a straight line.
No, not at all. As an option contract gets closer to its expiration date, the rate of time decay accelerates dramatically. It basically falls off a cliff in the final weeks.
So the near-term option you sold short is decaying incredibly fast. The longer-dated option you are long is decaying at a much slower, flatter rate.
Exactly.
Because you are short the fast melter and long the slow melter, you capture the difference in that decay rate day over day. The liability of the short leg vanishes faster than the asset of the long leg depreciates. You literally keep the difference.
Market posture is critical here, though. When you enter this trade, it is fundamentally direction neutral at entry. You do not want a massive rally, and you do not want a massive crash. You want boredom.
Absolute boredom. The absolute pinnacle of profitability for a calendar spread occurs if the underlying futures contract sits perfectly pinned to your chosen strike price on the exact day the near-term option expires.
So it's pinned right there.
If it pins the strike, the near-term option you sold expires worthless yielding maximum profit on that leg, while the longer-dated option you bought retains a massive chunk of its time value, which you can then just sell back to the market.
But the market rarely cooperates perfectly.
Yeah.
What is the catastrophic risk here? What happens if the market experiences a massive volatility shock and explodes upward or downward?
A violent move in either direction is detrimental to the calendar spread. If the market moves thousands of points away from your strike price, the options behave less like time decay instruments and more like intrinsic value instruments.
Oh, I see.
They will either both go deep in the money or deck out of the money. The mathematical difference in their respective decay rates collapses, your temporal edge evaporates, and the position loses money. But again, because you paid a net debit to enter the spread, your downside is strictly capped at that initial debit.
Right. It's a capped risk.
We have to hit the emergency brakes right here. I am grabbing the listener by the collar.
Listen to me. Here's where the exam will actively try to fail you. If you are listening to this on a run or driving, lock this into your memory. The test writers will actively try to induce a failure based on overlapping terminology.
It is the single most prevalent point of confusion in the spreading material.
The exam is going to present a question regarding an option calendar spread, which is the melting ice cube factory we just discussed. But in a completely different chapter of your study materials, you learned about a futures calendar spread.
The fact that financial nomenclature uses the exact same word for two wildly different mechanical trades is pure evil, honestly, but it is reality.
Right. Like, they couldn't designate one a time spread and the other a delivery spread. No, they use calendar for both. Let's build a firewall between these two concepts right now. Walk through the defining characteristics of the option calendar spread. Okay, the option calendar spread utilizes the exact same strike price across two different option expiration dates. The fundamental engine driving profitability is time decay, or theta.
Caps both sides, right.
Structurally, it is a fully capped position on both sides. Because you paid a net debit for options, your maximum loss is mathematically bounded regardless of how violently the market moves.
Now, compare that directly to the futures calendar spread you encounter in the carrying charge chapter.
A futures calendar spread, frequently referred to as an intra-market spread, does not involve options whatsoever. It involves buying a physical futures contract for one delivery month, say July corn, and selling a futures contract for a different delivery month, say December corn.
Just the physical futures.
Right. Because you're trading the actual futures contracts, there are no strike prices involved. The engine of this trade is not time decay, it is the cost of carry.
Storage and stuff.
Exactly. You are trading the economics of physical storage, insurance, and interest rates between those two delivery windows. Crucially, the risk profile is completely different. The risk is only capped in one direction when the market reaches full carry. If the market inverts due to a supply shock, the spread can move against you with theoretically unlimited risk.
So what does this all mean? Think about the implications for the exam room. When your eyes scan the question stem and register the phrase calendar spread, you cannot immediately look at the answer choices.
You have to pause.
You have to pause and verify the context. Is the question referencing options, strike prices, and time decay? Or is it referencing futures contracts, delivery months, and carrying charges? If you apply the logic of a futures carry spread to an options time decay question, you will generate the wrong answer 100% of the time.
It is a deliberate vocabulary trap, designed to test whether you're reading for comprehension or just reacting to keywords.
Let's shift gears for the final section. Desperate Dave is exhausted. He paid debits, he took directional bets, he even tried trading time with the calendar spreads, and he is just tired of the constant stress of market exposure.
It takes a toll.
He hears a rumor about riskless profit, the Holy Grail. He turns around at the coffee shop and meets our final character, Market Maker Marty.
The cold, calculating arbitrager.
Right. Market Maker Marty operates on an entirely different plane of existence than Dave or Kathy. He is a purely quantitative, algorithmic trader. He has absolutely no opinion on market direction.
He doesn't care if the economy is booming or in a recession. Marty's entire business model relies on identifying and exploiting microscopic mathematical misalignments in the options pricing matrix.
To understand how Marty prints money, we have to understand the mathematical anchor of his universe. What is the fundamental law he relies on?
It is a concept called put-call parity. Put-call parity dictates an unbreakable mathematical relationship between the price of a call option, the price of a put option, the strike price, and the current price of the underlying futures contract.
Unbreakable.
The core principle is this. If you buy a call option and simultaneously sell a put option at the exact same strike price and the exact same expiration date, you have constructed a synthetic long futures position.
Wait, let me break that down. Let's make sure I get this. If I buy the 100 call, I have the right to buy the market at 100. If I sell the 100 put, I have the obligation to buy the market at 100 if it drops.
Right.
So if the market rallies to 120, my call makes 20 points and the put expires worthless. If the market crashes to 80, my call expires worthless and I lose 20 points on the put I sold.
Point for point, tick for tick, this combination behaves identically to just buying a normal futures contract at 100.
Because the synthetic futures position and the real futures contract possess the exact same risk and reward profile at expiration, the laws of arbitrage dictate they must be priced identically, right?
Yes. However, financial markets are not perfectly efficient. During moments of extreme volatility or heavy institutional order flow, the price of the real futures contract and the price of the synthetic options position can briefly decouple.
They drift apart.
They drift apart for a few milliseconds. When that pricing gap opens, market maker Marty's algorithms step in to grab the pennies.
Because the logic of arbitrage is universal. If you have two assets that are mathematically guaranteed to be worth the exact same amount at expiration, but they are currently priced differently in the live market, what do? You buy the cheap one and you sell the expensive one.
Exactly. You lock in the price discrepancy, hold the positions until expiration when they're forced to snap back into parity, and you pocket the difference.
You have completely hedged away all directional risk. A market crash or a massive rally is irrelevant to you because your long position and short position cancel each other out perfectly. You just collected the anomaly.
Marty executes two specific structural trades to capture these anomalies: conversions and reversals.
Let's dissect the conversion first. The structural definition of a conversion is that Marty is long the real futures contract, long a put option, and short a call option.
Let's look at that options leg. Long a put and short a call at the same strike creates a synthetic short futures position. So he is long the real physical contract and short the synthetic options contract. They completely neutralize each other. What market condition triggers this trade?
I assume when something is overpriced.
A conversion is executed when the call option becomes mathematically overpriced relative to the put and the futures contract. The call is too rich. The fundamental rule of trading is to sell expensive assets. Marty wants to sell that ridiculously rich call option. By selling the call, buying the put to complete the synthetic short, and simultaneously buying the real futures contract to hedge away the delta risk, he successfully captures the inflated premium of that call option without taking on any directional exposure.
Okay, so the reversal is the exact structural opposite. A reversal means Marty is short the real futures contract, long a call option, and short a put option.
Right.
Being long a call and short a put creates a synthetic long futures position. He is short the real contract and long the synthetic. This triggers when the call option is underpriced in the market.
The call is too cheap.
The call is too cheap. He wants to buy the cheap asset. He buys the call, sells the put to fund it, and shorts the real futures contract to hedge the position.
In both the conversion and the reversal, the trader is marrying a real futures position with an opposing synthetic futures position. The directional risks perfectly offset, leaving a delta neutral near riskless spread that exists solely to harvest the mispricing.
Memorizing the exact mechanical legs long future, short call, long put is a nightmare under exam pressure. I have a memory trick that bypasses the rote memorization.
Let's hear it.
The rule is this: always trade against the mispriced call. In the exam question, they will almost always give you a hint that the call option is either overpriced or underpriced. Ignore the put, ignore the futures contract, focus entirely on the call.
Focus on the call.
If the call is too rich, too expensive, what do with expensive things? You sell them. Selling the call is the anchor of the conversion. If the exam says the call is too cheap, what do with cheap things? You buy them. Buying the call is the anchor of the reversal. Just trade against the call option.
That is a highly effective heuristic. But we must flag the final exam trap of this unit, which relates to the psychological framing of these trades. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the biggest mistake test takers make is treating these as directional bets.
The exam will frame a scenario. A trader identifies an underpriced call option and executes a reversal strategy. What is the trader's market outlook? A, strongly bullish. B, moderately bearish. C, neutral. D, arbitrage.
If you select bullish or bearish, you have completely misunderstood the fundamental architecture of the trade. These are purely hedged, near riskless arbitrage plays.
So the answer is arbitrage.
Exactly. The financial payoff of a conversion or a reversal is entirely independent of where the futures contract ultimately settles. They are trading the mathematical misalignment of the options chain, not the macroeconomic direction of the commodity.
We have covered a massive amount of technical ground today. The golden rules, the directional bets with Dave and Kathy, the time decay factory, and the algorithmic arbitrage of Marty. To make sure this is locked in before test day, let's run a rapid fire recap.
Let's do it.
Let's do this fast. Debit spreads. Ask yourself, what do they need to do?
Widen toward the strike difference. Max loss is the debit.
Right. Credit spreads.
Narrow toward zero. Max profit is the credit.
The sanity check.
Max profit plus max loss must equal the strike difference.
Option calendar spread.
Trades time decay, not direction. Caps both sides.
Conversions and reversals.
Arbitrage. Hedged. You are trading against a mispriced call, ignoring market direction entirely.
Boom. That is the architectural blueprint of the Series 3 option spreads unit. if you understand the engines we discussed today, you can deconstruct any scenario they throw at you.
As we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Think about market maker Marty.
The robot.
Right. He acts so fast to close these put-call parity gaps that retail traders like Desperate Dave will almost never see an arbitrage opportunity in the real world. Yet the exam demands you understand exactly how Marty's algorithms work. Why?
Because understanding the house is the only way to understand the game.
Because understanding how the house balances its books is the only way to truly understand how the options market prices risk. Ponder that next time you look at an options chain.
Deep thoughts. And always remember, if you pay the cover charge at the club, you need that party to widen. We will catch you on the next deep dive.